My name's Julie, I'm an addict.
Hi, Julie.
God, it's really nervous, you know. Over the years I've done a lot of chairs and I don't think I've felt as nervous as I have done with this one. I suppose this mic, I've got to try and imagine it's not there. And sign in to be taped. it's proof, I suppose, you know. And it was good. I'm really glad that Mark was sort of up here with me, because I do respect his recovery and he always shares an honest programme. And as he was speaking, he spoke about someone who died, and I know who he's talking about. And it is, you know, I do believe if I'd have stayed out there that I would have died. There weren't many options left for me. And God, I've got to try and calm down a bit. I'm really... Breathe. my experience, my strength and my hope. You know, I first come to meetings about 13 years ago, and I came in right aggressive, right angry, and I used to go to meetings and I was so unapproachable, you know. I'd sit there, I was like a snake, I used to just hiss. And then I used to quote to the most important person is the newcomer, and I used to think, well, why aren't these fucking bastards coming up to me then? You know, and I could never get my head round why they wouldn't come up to me, but I did throw off in my share, don't come near me. You know, I wouldn't have come near me in my early days. And what I was doing then, and looking back now, I know what I was doing. You know, I was really, I weren't ready to surrender, basically. And I carried on going to meetings, and I came into the rooms where my partner was already clean. He was about 2 years clean, but we knew each other. We'd used together and got nicked together, and you know, And I suppose where he was a bit in front of me, I used to look at his recovery and the people around him and think, oh yeah, you know, I should be feeling like this, I should be angry. And I lost that thought of, actually, I shouldn't be feeling nothing, I just want to use. And what I did was I clung on to a couple of people that I knew were the same as me. They weren't ready, and we used together. And I never declared that I was using. I suppose there was a part of me that felt that I'd fouled. And even this, I couldn't get right. You know, a lot of my life, I didn't seem to get right. You know, at school, I was very much... I was always in trouble. It weren't sort of mad trouble. I weren't sort of playing truant. It weren't really heavy trouble. It was more playing the clown. I'd hide the key and lock the teacher in the room and... anything for a laugh and that acceptance. You know, I used to want people to want to be with me. I used to want people to be my friend. And I used to really want to be liked. And I used to think by behaving in a certain way and attention seeking, if you like, that people would really like me. And I suppose even in my teenage years, you know, we used to sort of hang about the flats on an estate in sort of East London where there was like a youth club, and we'd all go down there. And even that, you know, I'd be the one, I'll you know, sniff this or sniff that or take this. And I would be up for everything, you know, and it would always... And I used to think, oh, they really like me. That's why they want me to go first. And I'd be up there, but I was always really the one that you could get at it. And I would always do these mad things, and I used to really crave for this acceptance. And, you know, even in my family, I'm the youngest. You know, Mark was talking about all them brothers, and I'm the youngest of sisters. I've got two older sisters. And it's one of them families where you never really spoke, you know, you never spoke about feelings. You never sort of got acknowledged sort of feeling-wise, And basically, we was a family of, you know, piss takers, really. You went home. If you had an haircut, you got slaughtered. If you bought anything new, you got slaughtered. And it was just, you used to sort of cling on to the hope that one of the other sisters or your mum has done something a bit sort of the same so that you wouldn't be the one being slaughtered. And I suppose I have, if in all honesty, I can be like that, where I can take the piss out of people. I think over the years, I've tried to do it where it's not so offensive. But in my recovery especially, there's been a lot of times I've had to go up to people and apologise, you know, for my insensitivity. And I would never have known that year. I never knew that years ago, you know, where I've said something. And it's not, I've not meant nothing by it. But I've said it and I've not thought of where this person's at. I've not thought of where this person's feeling and just said it. For that laugh and the laugh, say, off of you and you, but not took for granted where this other person's at. And a lot of times in my recovery, I've had to apologise for that. And, you know, my using was really rapid. You know, I weren't one of these people that, you know, I found my drug of choice pretty quick, and it was like I took this drug of choice when I was 15, and by 16 I was arrested, and about a week after my 16th birthday I was sent to prison. And I think it's funny because I've recently got another sponsor, and I've been because she wanted me, as much as I didn't want to do powerlessness again around drugs, she wanted me to do some examples and some examples of my behaviour now. And I was writing stuff, and each little bit of writing brings up another memory. And I was writing stuff and thinking, God, I was so scared back then. You know, going my first time to Holloway, I think where I used to watch Prison Cell Block H, I imagined that when I got to Holloway, I'm going to be attacked by lesbians. You know, the screws are going to all be like vinegar tits, and I'm just going to be abused. And, you know, it wasn't. If anything, what happened was there was a lot of women, younger girls my age, that was in the same predicament as me. It was their first time. And, you know, and I went and see the doctor, and he gave me substitution. And I remember I writ a letter to my mum and dad, and I was writing saying, oh, you know, they put me in there and these people are all murderers. And they weren't. They was on remand, the same as me. And it was anything. I'm very much, you know, make a situation a massive drama. And back then on remand, you didn't used to send out visitors' orders and that. They used to just be able to come up. And my dad come up the next day, and he was a big sort of 6 foot bit of a drinker, you know, and he went, I want to see one of these screws. And she came over, he went, look, she's fucking 17, she shouldn't be in here. And I'm going, yeah, she shouldn't be in here. Pop me. And my mum was going, yeah, you know, it was her birthday last week. I bought her a cake up, and it was a really big family. And it was the first time, if you like, that I look back on it now, and I see my mum and dad for what they were. You know, this my situation to them, it fucking slaughtered them. You know, and I think my dad especially, he used to have to get drunk before he come and visited me. And, you know, he sat on another chair at one point and thought he was seeing me, but it was someone else he was talking to. You know, he used to have to literally get paralytic because it fucking hurt him. And my mum was just denial. She was like, oh, well, you know, just it's like being at school, but they're going to make you sleep here and blah, blah, blah. And that's how she coped. And, you know, after that first time, where it weren't as bad as I imagined, when I did come out and continue using, you know, it was a thing of my attitude was, when I was going out at it, was, well, fuck it, what's the worst that can happen? I'm going to end up nicked. And, you know, I could do with a break. I'm down to, what, 6 stone? So I put a bit of weight on and back I go again. And that went on for a few years. And then my dad died. He died pretty young. He was 49. He had an heart attack. And I stopped using gear. And I went on that one of pills and drink. And in a way, although it was a mad time because my behaviour was a bit worse than just the gear, now what it does for me is it says to me that I can't drink and I can't use, you know, and I don't judge anyone who uses pills, etc. But for me, they were part of my using. You know, I used Valium and Temazepam and Rohypnol, and anything that caused drowsiness was up for abuse with me. And on the outside, I suppose you could say I looked like I was quite coping, because I suppose where I used to graft and have the clothes, if you like, and go in shops and that, on the outside, although I was really skinny, and if you lifted up my arms, I was full of scabs, I looked all right. obviously not, but I used to think I looked all right. And I suppose, you know, people speak about their rock bottoms. You know, I did have a few. And when I first, like I said, when I first did come into recovery, I suppose I had to have this thing, because when I was in prison, there weren't NA, but there was AA. But there was always this thing in my head where I have to be, you know, something has to prove with me. And when I got out, there was a couple of people who I used with, who I knew really used, who were going to this thing called NA. And that's when I sort of got in touch with an old partner and started going again. You know, and when I relapsed back then, that 13 years ago when I did relapse, it was, although I can talk about it now and say, well, you know, that was my journey, that was my path, it was probably one of the most painfulest, maddest time, because when you use, once you've got a bit of this recovery, it does fuck your using. You know, you sort of sit there and you have like, you be, you know, you have powerlessness and you made a decision to use, and it really clear messages come up for you. And during this time, I got pregnant, and it was a really sort of mad time, because it was like, well, I had about 7 months. So I've got 7 months. What I'm going to do is cut down the gear. I'm going to do this and I'm going to do that, and then I'm going to get to the end and I'm going to have this baby and everything could be fine and it'll be the Waltons and we'll have happily ever after. And, you know, it never went that way at all. It was... I did cut down, and my head, you know, it's like before I'd done this chair, sometimes my head can be so full up, because coming up to the birth of that baby, I was thinking, it's going to be all right, everything's going to be all right, you know, this faith of it's going to be all right. And there is a part of me that did believe that. And it also showed me, if you like, how deceitful and what a liar I can be. And I had all these nurses. I was admitted to hospital about 11 weeks before I had him, and I had all these nurses lying, you know, no one had given me my medication in front of visitors because it was hush-hush, no one knew I was using. You know, the doctors would say that I'm in for an high blood pressure, but they'd admitted me to try and get me off, well, to try and cut me down before I gave birth. And my partner was, we're still going meetings, I'm talking recovery with him, but I'm using. One of them obstetrician come in and he said to me, I need to make you aware that when you give birth, the baby's going to have to go in this special care unit. And I suppose it hit me then. It was about 2 weeks before I was due to give birth, and it hit me that my decisions to use were actually affecting someone else, and it was this innocent child that's not even been born yet. And then he said to me, and you need to tell your partner, because your partner needs to be made aware that once you've give birth, this child is going to be put into a special care unit. And my God, I was so fucking scared, you know, and it's the same sort of sick stomach feeling that I had before doing this chair. And I couldn't tell him. I had to get the doctor to tell him. I said, I didn't have the arsehole to tell him. I said, the doctor told him, and he just walked out. And my mum come up to see me, and even that, the lie I told there was the reason I'm in hospital with this such a skinny body but a bit of a stomach is because I've got a cyst. And she did believe me. You know, my mum believed me, and I had to tell her as well that I'm pregnant. And she'd already brought up my other son, who's... Well, he lives with me now, but he's 20 now. And when I told her, she said to me, I can't do it again. I can't have another one of your kids. So The best thing you can do, if you can't stop what you do, the best thing you can do is give him up for adoption or put him into care, because it's not fair what you're doing. And I come away from that, and she's never been that sort of honest with me, if you like. And I think it was her way of saying, I ain't got it in me to do it again. And I sort of went back to my bed and thought, it's make or break. It's, you know, and it was, now it's like days before I'm giving birth, and my partner was up at the hospital and he was so fucking angry, and his anger was really valid, and I had to accept his anger. I had to accept that I was on my own giving birth, and I had to accept that I'd let a lot of people down who I'd formed these mad relationships with in NA, who found it hard to support me anymore. And I was in this hospital, and it was mad, because I started sort of, you know, jumping ahead a bit. I started to go into labour, and I was on my own, but there was a mad decision come up where I was on a real little bit of methadone by now, and I thought, this is it, I'm going to stop. And a drama, you know, the nurse said to me, do you want your pethidine? And I said, no, I'm clean. And she said, do you want any gas and air? And I said, no, I'm clean. She went, do you want epidural? I said, no, I'm clean. Now, this went on, I suppose, 20 past seven, I started going into labour. And then about 9 o'clock, by now I'm clucking and I'm saying no to every drug, and I'm in labour. And she said, you sure you don't want gas and air? And I was going, no, I'm clean. And then all of a sudden it really hit me. The labour really come on, and I was on my own. And I said, I need something. She said, you can't, it's too late. You know, the head's there. And I gave birth. And at first, it's funny, because all the doctors come in and they looked and they said, he's okay, actually. So far, he's okay. They go by their temperature and they do this, like, score sheet. And it's quite vivid at the moment, because I'm writing about it. And they tick how many times they sneeze, and it's really fucking heavy, actually. And anyway, I was put in this special ward where all, like, you got people on crack. People, it's a ward, basically, with mothers and babies. I didn't know these wards exist. This is the maddest place I've ever seen. And he was all right. For the first few hours, he was all right. And this nurse kept coming to check him, and he weren't screeching. He was all right. And then all of a sudden, he done this thing with his little hand where he shook. And the doctor said, look, he's a soldier. He's all right. But the nurse was like, nah, don't, it's not fair what you're doing. Let him have something. They give him what's called this morphine, but a real small dose. And I allowed him to give the morphine. And for 3 days, I sat with him. And, you know, when he sneezed, when he was sick, I sat with him. And within 3 days, they took him off it, and he was all right. He was really all right now. And I had this meeting with social workers where my partner had come up now, and he was still really angry, and he was still really going into me. But he come to this meeting with social workers, and I'm telling them I'm 4 days clean, blah, blah, blah. And I won the decision to not have him at, it's called this at risk. You sort of get a decision made in that hospital, and they didn't put him there. And I mean, thankfully, I came home and stayed clean, because they didn't know whether I stayed clean. And I came home. I came out, and I'd done what was suggested. I came back. I went to meetings. I took this little baby to meetings, and I carried on, accepted this, and put up with my partner's anger. And then I suppose it got to about 2 months clean, and I got that strength that you only get from these rooms, where you get this inner strength where you say, actually, no more. You know, and I'd allowed him his anger, and I'd allowed him to keep coming round every day and telling me what a fucking bitch I was and blah, blah, blah. And then one day he come round and I said, look, make a decision. You either support me or go. I can't handle this no more. And he, it turned around really for us. And, you know, I'm still with him today. And my son's, he was 10 in March, and I was 10 years clean in March. And I suppose that's the, I have to, as much as I don't always like sort of saying about that situation, I have to, because that was my story, and that's what brought me to these rooms. And it's not nice, it's not the best of stories, it's not, I suppose, what you'd call a joyful story, but it's my experience. And, you know, at first I really slung myself into recovery and being this mother, and, you know, I got a sponsor and I started doing the steps. And my mum, after about a year clean, my mum got cancer. And she died really quick. It sort of progressed, and she died within, 18 months. When I was 18 months clean, she died. And I think that was the first time, although I had faith, because I had faith when I gave birth, I had faith I was going to be okay. But I think when my mum died was the faith that I don't have to use. I can get through this without using, and it was devastating. And I'd go to meetings and I cried. I think I cried for about 2 months. I'd just go to meetings and couldn't believe that this person who'd been in my life all my life, visited me in prisons, you know, looked after my kids, fed me, cleaned me when I needed cleaning, and she was just took from me. And there was this faith that came up from saying, you're going to be all right, you don't need to use. And my family, and where I come from, if you like, a funeral, a wedding, a christening, it's in a pub. And I went to the funeral, you know, and we went to the pub afterwards, and you know, people spoke about me, mum and me dad, because it was both their friends there. And I was able to stand there and watch my sisters drink brandy and get really, really drunk to a point where they started singing, which I thought was really inappropriate, and left. But I stayed there with, you know, and I was quite dignified. You know, she would have been really proud of my behaviour in that pub. You know, because usually, and when I drank, you know, my behaviour was mad. You know, I'd get a mic, I'd sing, and I'm tone deaf. You know, and I'd go to a pub. I went to a pub. I mean, I'm not going to tell you the full gist of this, but I went to a pub one day and I ordered a drink. He went, "No, I don't think so, love, you're barred." And I thought, well, and I come away and I just thought, fucking hell, you know, and I did, you know, apparently I don't say it right out of order. And that was my behaviour, you know, where. But at this place, you know, and at this funeral, my sisters was really slurring, and then they, you know, they got louder and louder, and their stories always come back to me. You know, they start off with this little old, you know, she's doing really well, didn't she look well, Julie, blah, 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 and they start like that, and then it's like, yeah, that fucker nicked all my jewellery, and then it goes into a story. And the stories go, and I think I need to remove myself, and that's the best thing I could do for myself in them situations now, right? I do remove myself, because my using did, you know, as much as there's my story there, my behaviour, I done whatever I needed to do to get my money, and shamefully to say, I did steal from my parents, you know, and my sisters, and my nan, you know, and not, sometimes it'd be borrowing money, but with the, if you never, you know, you did know if you borrowed me money, you weren't getting it back. And I suppose that's another good thing in recovery, you know, because over, and it took a little time for me. I think where they had that episode where I cleaned up and no one knew I was using, and then I came back again, it took a long time to build that trust up with people, where they started, you know, my mum would leave her bag with me, and then, you know, when she got ill, she used to let me get her shopping, and I used to have to do her signature with her card, which I was quite good at back then. And she trusted me to do that, whereas before, you know, I would have emptied her. I would have emptied her, the bank account. And, you know, and that trust came sort of slowly but surely. And, you know, and after she died, you know, I really slung myself into meetings, and unfortunately, I had to let go of my sponsor, and it had a bit of an impact, if I'm honest. And it was not, now I look back on it, it wasn't really her. I had this great expectation that she should have done this and that and this to support me, and she should have done this, and you know, she should have done that, and she didn't. And the reality was, you know, it was my expectations, and she's human the same as me. And it took a little while for me to go there again with a sponsor. And a lot of times I'd come to meetings and I weren't getting it all. I weren't getting all this program has to offer. And I knew for a long time that I weren't getting everything this program. You know, sometimes I look at people, and there's a couple of them in this room who've got a lot of years, and I see them do so much service and so much work on themselves. And I think that's what I want, and that's that. And the only thing that's missing is that I'm not giving it 100%. You know, I can be there for people, I can be a good friend, but I need to do that 100% on myself to get what these people have got. And so obviously what I did then was I went online to get a sponsor. And I found one in America who used to send me these things every day from Spiritual Wings, telling me how much she loved me. And it used to be great, because she never used to ask me what's going on. And I used to think, oh, yeah, because now I can go to meetings. I can say, I've got a sponsor. I'm working the steps with this woman. And I was kidding myself. The only person I was kidding was me. And I went back to someone who over the years, I like her recovery. You know, she's a lovely lady. And we met up again, and we spoke. We spent a lot of time speaking, and we're meeting up again next week, where I'm going to share my first bit of writing, and that's been different. You know, just reading the literature, you know, for a long time I didn't read it, you know, and to actually put pen to paper, and then remember that when you're writing about something, these other memories that come up, and it's been, I suppose, where I've done such a, I don't know, thorough step one, if you like, the first time around. And my step one was really apparent. It was really quite simple, you know, the powerlessness around drugs when I was pregnant and the unmanageability that caused my life. And it was really apparent, that powerlessness. And I had no problem with powerlessness. And then doing it again and I suppose resurfacing their memories, and it was quite painful, and there were some of them I actually forgot, which was quite good for a couple of years. And now there's my behaviour now, you know, there's certain things I've found in my life in recovery, if you like, that have helped me get through stuff. And I found gambling has been a big one for me, you know, where, and it weren't sort of bookies, although at first, when I first sort of came around, I used to, it was like going in a pub, you know, I could go in the bookies, and where my dad used to bet, I used to know all these talks about who's the trainer and is this grand soft, and I used to feel right part of in the bookies with all these fucking Irishmen. And for a while that fixed me, you know, because I'd really fantasize about winning a lot of money, and it fixed me, and then it didn't, and I thought, right, I'm going to go bingo. And my mum used to go bingo, and there was that sort of connection with her, I suppose, as well. And it became so fucking private. Everything I do that can you can act out on is such a seedy, private little affair. And that's what happened with bingo. You know, I'd go, then I'd get bored with just playing the books. So I'd go on these big machines that you never win on. And I know you never win on, and I know the only person who's the winner is the person with a key to empty the fucking thing, but it never stopped me. It never stopped me from going on there. You know, and that, to write about the powerlessness around that, you know, changing another 20 quid and thinking to myself, right, all right, I'll get me social on Monday, I can do this, and you weigh up, and it's, you know, and then when you come and you've lost, the remorse and the feelings around it are exactly the same as using. You know, the lying to sort of compensate for the amount of money you've lost, and the escape, it is exactly the same. And writing about that was a revelation as well. You know, I do believe, and it's funny, I've been so resistant with these steps, But I do believe they're there to be done. I don't think you can comfortably do recovery and white knuckle it. And honestly, I'm talking from experience here. And as much as I'm not going to knock myself, I'm proud of myself today. I'm also going to say, you know, don't wait as long as I have, because I know that the answer is in these steps. And I know you need to do this work on yourself to be able to be yourself. You know, and we're all worth that. You know, and a lot of things, I don't know, I was just thinking, you know, what have I achieved over the years? And I've achieved so much sort of over the years. You know, I've got such a good relationship with my kids today. You know, my older one is a bit of a wise boy, you know, and there's a bit of guilt there, I suppose, where my mum had him. He's a bit of a piss taker, you know. I gave him his birthday money. He was 20 the other day. And he went out, and I know he's been down the bookies. And he come back and he went, "Oh, right, I lost me money." And he's looking on the floor for it. And I just thought, God, does he not remember that he told me this last week that he lost his money? And, you know, and sometimes I think to myself, sometimes he forgets, but then he don't. I mean, he's dad, because my partner's not his dad who I'm with today. And his dad is still very much on crack. And he's got emphysema now, his dad, and he's got one of them breathing machines, and he still uses. And sometimes my son stays with him, and so he sees both sides. He sees his dad, who's, I don't know, he's never had enough. And I really do believe he'll die of this disease. And then he's got me, and I don't know, and sometimes I think I'd really like him to have a bit more zest for life. He seems to have sort of accepted it's all right to just sign on, get up at 1 o'clock, take money from me, and I accept that as well. And part of that with me is I'm making up for the years, I suppose, I wasn't there. And it's getting better, you know, I'm getting a bit harder with him, but it's an hard one. But he has, you know, he don't really bring the police to my door, and I'd like to think he's not using. I know he smokes, but I'd like to think he's not using. And my 10-year-old, you know, he's so innocent. You know, I've got him who's been exposed to a load of shit, my older one, but I've got my younger one who the other day asked me what booze was, and he's 10, and I thought, oh, bloody hell, he's not. He's never been in a pub. And, you know, and that's I suppose that's the joys of staying clean. You know, I learnt to communicate. You know, when I first came in, I used to hide behind my hair. I had this really long hair, and I'd hide my face. And for the first 3 months, I didn't share. And I was so nervous. And I had this thing of I didn't know how to talk. You know, my communication was, what's happening, who's got? Later. And that was my skills, you know, and over the years, you know, I learned how to say when something bothers me. I've learned to say, well, actually, you know, I've learned how to confront people. I've learned how to accept when I'm confronted. I've learned how to say sorry when I'm wrong. You know, I've learned how to be a mum. I've learned how to be a sister. You know, some of the time, especially with family, you know, has been really painful where I've, you know, and before they're, you know, because when I first, you know, early doors, my elder sisters, my relationship with her has always been a bit, you know, and when I first got nicked, she's very much the one who forgets where she comes from, but she moved to Chatham and she was automatically posh. And she'd come round my dad's house, go, "Oh, you've got her in here, and, you know, I'm not going to stay. Hold your wallet, Bob," to the boyfriend. And as the years went on, I got nicked, and I got bowel conditions to live and sleep at home. And I never went home. Anyway, I was walking along the street, and the police pulled up and said, "There's a warrant out," and then I was nicked again. And when I got to the police station, there was this statement from my sister saying, my sister's bail conditions are that she lives and sleeps at home. Well, I can say that 11:40 last night, she didn't come home and blah, blah, blah. And I was raging because I've gone to court and my dad come to court to a magistrate's. And he got in the box and said, you know, they're sisters, they hate each other, there's that. And the judge said, you know, I don't believe for one minute that one sister would do this to another, remanded in custody. And it burnt me. I mean, I laid in myself thinking, I'm going to put gear in that fucker's ass. She is. Oh, it truly, truly burnt me. And when I cleaned up, she was still really snotty. She still is to this day quite snotty, but, you know, I choose to stay away from her. And she kept making these comments. My dad had been dead all. He'd been dead a few years now. And every time I see her, she'd go, yes, well, you know, daddy would still be alive if it wasn't for you, you know, the life. And the reality is all the men in his life, in my dad's family, never lived past 50. They had this heart problem and his valves were furred. He used to drink and he had an heart attack. And she used to go on. But there was part of me, a little tiny part of me that thought I did cause the man a lot of worry, so maybe... And she kept doing it, but I think where I was so early doors, I was so raw, if you like, that I was so shaky with anger. And she said it this day, and I thought, oh, I've got to sort her out. I've got to mark her card. She can't keep doing this. And I got up, and I was with my partner. I got up about 7 in the morning because she used to work at BT. She used to be management in BT. And I went and plotted up on her. I took my earrings off. It was proper. It was proper going off. And and she come down the stairs, and bless her, you know, I did attack her. You know, and funny enough, you know, I'm not going to say that's the way to deal with people, because I don't think it is. And but funny enough, she did show me a level of respect after that. She Well, she did. You know, she... When I say a level of respect, she stopped these fucking comments, you know, which really hurt me, you know. And the funny thing was, I'm not really a fighter, but she got me to such a place with her hurtful comments that I had this uncontrollable... And it's funny, because there was workmen digging in this road, and during the attack, I pulled her shirt off. And they was loving it. I go, go on, girl, you know... And she was just in tears, you know. She said, I can't believe you've done that, you know. I'm going to fucking get you arrested, you know. You're going to go back in our heart. And it's funny, I saw my mum on the balcony watching, and she didn't stop it. And anyway, I went back to the partner who, bless him, I left him in bed and went back to the house, sneaked in, put my nightdress back and didn't say a word. I didn't go to a meeting and share about it. And it was quite normal, you know. I was so... God, she done me. And then I did. I shared it with someone. It's funny. I was speaking to this woman who had a few years, and I said, yeah, you know, she said, how are you? I went, I'm all right. I said, I feel a bit funny. I feel a bit shaky. You know, I attacked my sister this morning and blah, blah, blah. And she went, so why on earth didn't you share that? And I was like, well, why would I do that? And... You know, and she gave me her number and you know, bless her, she's still around today. And she really helped me through that time, because it was really, really difficult time. And that's what I think in recovery, you get dealt certain stuff. And as the years have gone on, I mean, I wouldn't dream of dealing with a situation like that today. I would like to think I wouldn't dream of dealing with a situation like that today. And, you know... I'm very much walk away. If I see something getting out of hand with my family today, because my sisters can still be like that, especially the eldest one, and I do, I stand back, I walk away. It's too painful. They have a lot of power, and by standing there and allowing them to hurt me is giving them power, and today I choose not to give people that kind of power. I've been working in recovery. You know, someone in recovery heard me share one day and he offered me a job, and on and off I've worked for him for 8 years now, and I've not been in lately because I had an operation. And it's funny, you know, it's again, it's that trust. You know, he's trusting me with the firm's money, the firm's keys, ordering of computer stuff, and you know, I've had this element of trust, and I don't think you'd, well, I certainly wouldn't have had that in my using. And you know, my life today is really good. You know, I come to meetings, I've got some beautiful friends in my life. I've got a sponsor. I'm actually looking forward to doing the steps, the full go this time. I've got a service position. And it is, life's really good. I've always had faith. You know, one thing I think that's kept me clean is I have a good faith. I have a God of my understanding who I pray to. I pray. I was in that toilet and I couldn't get on my knees because it was too fucking small in there. But I begged him to get me, or her, to get me through this. And, you know, they have. I've got through it. I didn't think I would. It was, wow. But I've got through it and I'm clean today. And it's lovely to be here. And thank you for sharing, Mark, and thanks everyone for listening.